Hello, friends. It's the Environment Show, and welcome. Don't let them do it. This is the slogan of a nationwide campaign being mounted by several environmental organizations in response to proposed congressional action. The Sierra Club says 25 years of protection could be lost. Others say not so. We're at the dawn of a new age. Also this time, in Chattanooga, it's a vision thing taking them into a new age.
A whole millennium lies before us. A new 100 years, new decades, new opportunities. Why shouldn't we spend our time excitedly thinking out what that future might be and then making it happen?
The Environment Show, a national production made possible by Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the old car hobby, 1-800-C-A-R-H-E-R-E. And this is Bruce Robertson.
This is a paid announcement. It's great to go back to the beach.
Hey, but look what's in the water.
Oh, gross.
Future summers could be a wipeout because Congressman Gary Franks voted with special interests.
This is one of a series of radio ads that we are running all across the country to try to wake up the American public and let them know what members of Congress are doing to the basic safeguards that they have counted on for the last 25 years to protect their health and safety.
Bruce Hamilton is director of the Sierra Club's conservation program in San Francisco. Hamilton says action pending in Congress could have the effect of dismantling 25 years of hard work to protect the environment.
You know, for some reason, Newt Gingrich and the rest of the congressional leadership thinks that the American public wants less clean water, and we just don't believe that's the case, and we need to get this word out to the American people.
Is this a particularly more critical time in congressional legislation and the government process than we've ever seen in the last 15 to 20 years or so?
Well, you could even go back further than that. This is the most serious assault we've ever had on the environment. This is far worse than the days of James Watt and Ronald Reagan, for instance, because at least then we had a stalemate between what the White House and the administration was trying to do and what the Congress was trying to do. In this particular case, there's this real juggernaut moving, but it's a hidden war on the environment. So far, the American public hasn't really seen it. You know, when James Watt was out there back in the Reagan years, you know, it was on the front pages of all the magazines, on the nightly news, and everybody recognized that here was James Watt. He was the arch enemy of the environment, and the arch enemy was out there doing evil, and they needed to rise up to take arms against it. Well, in this case, this is a stealth attack on the environment. They come in and they use other terms in order to describe what they're doing. You know, if you look at the contract with America, it never mentions the word environment. And yet buried in that contract with America is a hidden war on the environment that can take away all of your health and safety protections. And they never say that they're doing that. And so it really takes radio ads like we just heard and other things like that to get the American people to understand what's going on. And when they understand, they're outraged. We basically have, you know, corporate America coming in through the back door, giving large campaign contributions to Congress, and Congress in turn having them write the legislation that they want to dismantle the laws that have been in their ways for a long time, and then adopt something totally new that is not in the public interest.
This from the environmental community. There are other interpretations, as you might expect. Jonathan Adler is director of environmental studies at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, a conservative think tank in Washington.
It's certainly not true that the regulatory reform efforts of this Congress will lead to environmental decimation. What these reform efforts are long overdue attempts to rationalize and set basic ground rules for regulatory action in the environmental area and other areas. Furthermore, this Congress will hopefully proceed to re-examining and reforming the basic underlying environmental statutes, because these statutes were written at a time when wage and price controls were considered sound economic policy, and we didn't understand nearly as much as we do today about how best to achieve environmental protection in a manner that is consistent with economic growth and individual liberty.
While this might be the intention of the new Congress, the Sierra Club's Bruce Hamilton says, what we read in the papers and hear over the air is true. Much environmental legislation will be gutted. A perfect example is the Clean Water Act, one of many up for revision this year.
The bill that just passed the House of Representatives is a bill that basically rewrites the way that we propose to keep our waters clean. We call it the Dirty Water Act as it passed the House, and so does a lot of editorial boards from the New York Times to USA Today. And the reason is because they basically have gone through, the polluting industries have, and said, here's all the things that bother us about this law and why we want them changed. And all those were then incorporated by the committee. I mean, I'm not exaggerating. When the committee met to mark this up, they allowed the polluting industries in there to write the legislation, and they did not even invite the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency to come in and comment on the legislation or to talk about how to improve it.
Again, Jonathan Adler.
This is nothing new.
Well, but it's
industrial lobbyists and environmental lobbyists and special interest lobbyists have written environmental and other legislation for decades. This is nothing new in this Congress. Working in Washington, D.C., it is amusing to hear people say how shocked they are that politics happens in politics. The reality is that special interest lobbyists helped write the Clean Air Act amendments of 1990. Special interest lobbyists helped write the Clean Air Act amendments of 1977. Special interest lobbyists helped write the Clean Water Act. Special interest lobbyists helped write the Superfund reform amendments in the mid-80s. The fact is that the more we put environmental decision-making in Washington, the more special interest lobbyists, including industrial lobbyists, will be involved in that process. Because mom and pops, and individual citizens, individual constituents, do not have the money, do not have the expertise, do not have the time to be actively involved in a political process. But the reality is that industrial lobbyists always will and always have. And this is nothing new. They have been doing this for decades. And this has been documented in various books over the years. And it is almost comical that folks are complaining about it today.
Hamilton says we should remember the Cuyahoga River, aflame with petroleum byproducts, the syringes that washed ashore at many beaches, the great lakes that once were great dead inland seas, the cryptosporidium that poisoned Milwaukee, the jack-in-the-box E. coli deaths. These and more, he says, we could see again.
You know, the American public, I'm sure, will not stand for it, and people will start dying and will start having these kind of outbreaks because they're basically unleashing the polluters. They're carrying out their wishes. They aren't carrying out the wishes of the American people. And it's because the polluters are writing the bills, and they're overreaching. And as soon as the American people find out about this, they're going to be outraged.
Adler says not only will Congress not approve continuing the old style of environmental management, Adler says we will fail if we insist on preserving that old method.
Washington, D.C.'s environmental establishment has made the mistake of conflating centralized federal environmental regulation with environmental protection. There are other ways of protecting the environment that rely upon to a greater extent on state and local governments, on private initiative, on private conservation efforts, which have a proud history in this country, and on the marketplace itself. We need to look more to shoring up protections of private property, both against government actions as well against polluters and privately created nuisances. We need to do more to base our environmental protection on a conception of protecting people and their properties from harm and less upon Washington, D.C. micromanaging all industrial activity.
Hamilton insists that American voters did not vote for the kind of change that is now underway in Congress.
That is a very radical anti-environmental majority that is controlling the House. And so it's really the improper question to say, how come you aren't winning in the House? Have you been asleep at the wheel? You know, the point is that that particular House, we cannot win a vote now. And we cannot win a vote there until the American people wake up and understand what's going on and get outraged and contact their members of Congress and say, this has got to change. I voted for change, but I didn't vote for this kind of change. Who the heck do you think you are representing?
Bruce Hamilton, Director of National Conservation with the Sierra Club in San Francisco. Jonathan Adler is Director of Environmental Studies with the Competitive Enterprise Institute in Washington. The rest of the 104th Congress promises to be interesting, if it is anything. As we watch the proceedings on the Hill, no doubt we will ask, did we get what we wanted, or do we want what we got? This is Bruce Robertson. Here's a story.
As we passed an aloe plant around, we broke off one piece
and spread its thick, viscous juices on curious hands. A deer skull, cured hides of various western animals, sand and dried flowers, went hand to hand around the circle. We introduced people to baby mice and to our 5-foot gopher snake. Stories that convey our connection with the natural world extended the discussion. We were sitting on a rug in a circle of parents and children. One girl seemed separate, although her mother held her in her lap next to the other children. Jenny had been born with cerebral palsy, and its physical effects meant on her that she moved to her own rhythm and seemed far away in a world of her own. We noticed that some of the other children seemed uncomfortable with her abrupt, uncontrolled movements, unaccustomed to appear like Jenny. As the program continued, evoking the experiences of the desert environment, an attentive, respectful rapport developed, allowing the wildlife to be brought in. I brought the Swainson's hawk quietly in on my gloved hand, her pride and dignity palpable in the room. Suzanne spoke about the hawk's permanent injury. Her fractured shoulder prevents her from flying well enough to hunt for her food and to migrate. Yet even with this injury, she is whole. Her spirit is whole. Jenny's mother looked up at Suzanne, saying proudly, "Yes, that's how I see my daughter. That's my daughter the hawk."
Rebecca Reynolds reading from a collection of vignettes in a collected book called Bring Me the Ocean. Rebecca Reynolds, the author of this, she's also president of the Seabury School in Concord, Massachusetts, which is a sort of umbrella organization for the animals intermediaries. Welcome to the program, and that's a very powerful story, one of a collection of stories in this book. They're all true stories, as I sort of think of them as vignettes. Describe more fully what this book is, this collection.
Well, the book's been gathered over the years. It's really come from the stories we see rising up as we do a program. We'll be bringing nature and the arts and animals, music, plants, all of this into hospital settings. And when we do that, bringing the environment indoors, stories just naturally rise up with the interactions. And so we've been gathering these over the years, and now it's a collection in book form.
The story that you read about truly hands-on experiences with items from nature and the story of Jenny, what is the story? What was going on at that episode?
That story, I think, is kind of a core story almost in a way, because what we're often addressing in bringing the materials into the hospital setting or into any setting is really touching the human spirit, and that nature makes that link that then has almost inherent metaphors within it where we can recognize something that is a parallel to our own experience. And with Jenny, I think what the mother was really speaking to is that even with cerebral palsy, and that the other children really felt estranged from her and were uncomfortable with her because of her spasticity and her movements, that really her mother knows that she's completely whole. And although on the surface there may seem to be a physical disability, that she knows that her daughter's spirit is intact, and that even with injury or with disability or with emotional difficulties, that is still very true. And I think the wildlife speak to that in a beautiful way.
The title of the collection comes from another of the vignettes, Bring Me the Ocean.
"Bring me the ocean," declared Jim. "Not the moon, not the stars. No, he wanted the ocean." This was the second time Jim had asked for the ocean, and we were perplexed. How could we transport the ocean indoors to a chronic care hospital setting? When he asked us again, Suzanne said, "How can we possibly bring you the ocean?" "In buckets," Jim replied, spelling it out letter by letter on his communication board. Several years before, well in his early 30s, Jim had suffered a head injury. The accident had left him triplegic and unable to communicate orally. Now he used a communication board on the armrest of his wheelchair to tell us his thoughts. On our next visit, we arrived with sloshing buckets full of salty Atlantic Ocean. Other pails held seaweed, mussels, clams, periwinkles, and a lobster, all on loan from the sea for the day. Along with the hospital staff, we discovered that Jim had not yet told any of us. He had been a lobsterman prior to his injury. The ocean had been his livelihood. Every day, in bad weather and good, he'd been out on the ocean, pulling up his line of lobster pots, sorting the catch, and rebaiting the traps. A past emerged, and Jim showed us that anything, even the ocean, can be brought indoors to an institution.
Rebecca Reynolds, reading from her collection of stories titled Bring Me the Ocean. It is available from Vanderwick and Burnham in Acton, Massachusetts. Reynolds says these stories point two ways, to the healing power of nature on broken humans, and to the charge healthy humans have to help heal broken nature. This is Bruce Robertson. You're listening to The Environment Show. Yet to come, the story of Chattanooga Venture. For a cassette copy of today's broadcast, phone 1-800-747-7444. Ask for The Environment Show, program number 284. In Chattanooga, they are visioning. It's a verb describing a process by which people, anybody and everybody, are taking control of their lives. They also call it empowerment. The process is deliberate, sanctioned by the city government, and highly organized. It even has a name, Revision 2000. Dr. Jim Catanzaro is chair of the organization. Catanzaro says two things were happening in his community that created a desperate need for some type of action.
One is that this was a community controlled by negativism. Back in the early 80s, late 70s, the economy was falling apart. It was a rust belt, but not in the rust belt. It was part of the rust belt nevertheless. And there was a sense that the city perhaps couldn't recover on its own. And yet, I think when you put people against the wall, amazingly enough, the human spirit rebounds. It finds new life, new vitality. And I think that's in part what happened here. The people were desperate and said, let's take it into our own hands. Let's find a way out of this morass that we're in. Let's see if we can frame a future for ourselves, among ourselves.
The other thing that was happening, says Catanzaro, was that everyone was made to feel their ideas were equally valuable. There was agreement that something needed to be done, and there was agreement that everyone could be part of the solution.
When people came to believe that they had the power to change the course of the community, and that their ideas were going to be acted on, amazingly enough, they were generous toward other people's ideas, and a consensus would form around this notion or that notion or this goal or that goal. And I think most astonishingly, the resources that most folks didn't think existed in this community somehow appeared almost magically, because everyone wanted to be part of the fulfillment of it, not just part of the framing of the ideas, but part of the achievement of those ideas.
The year was 1984. 1,700 citizens came together and drew up a long wish list of projects needing attention. The city's school system needed emergency treatment. The downtown was crumbling. The waterfront along the Tennessee River was degraded, polluted, and forbidding. Chattanooga Creek was a prime candidate for Superfund site designation, and air pollution remained a serious threat. The early meetings soon became organized with a name, Chattanooga Venture, they called it, with a mission at first called Vision 2000, and then, after a second visioning process launched in 1993, it became known as Revision 2000. Today, it is a 32-member board headed by Catanzaro. He says it is their job to convene meetings, to allow people to come and talk. He says the energy behind the early meetings continues unabated today.
There's been a multiplier effect to all this. It's hard to describe in social scientist terms, behavioral scientist terms, but there's a direct and definite multiplier effect. Some things occur, people see that they happen, that they're successful, and they risk their own resources. So many of the things that have happened in Chattanooga have not happened because of Revision 2000 or Vision 2000 originally. They have happened as a result of the secondary effects of those visioning processes. New ideas, like all these ideas that we're pursuing about sustainability, the excitement we have over permaculture and developing sustainable communities and zero-emission industrial parks and the like, that was not to be found in Revision 2000, although there were many environmental initiatives that were identified. But I think those are part of just the climate of our community now, which is a can-do climate, as opposed to the old conditions that existed here and do exist in many parts of America, where people immediately think of those reasons why you shouldn't be able to do it and can't do it and throw roadblocks up in the way. The opposite kind of thinking, by and large, dominates our community now, and that's why I think these things won't cool down. They'll continue to burn hot.
The visioning process is addressing a wide array of issues in Chattanooga, from inner city revitalization to industrial expansion to environmental protection and restoration. Catanzaro says no matter the project, there is a common theme, namely empowerment of the citizens.
We're always looking for the government or someone to manage us into a fulfillment of an idea or goal. But even corporate America has found that making employees stakeholders, empowering them, building teams, bringing people information instead of keeping information from them, ultimately produces the results and produces the support for the goal once it's in operation. And I believe the same thing is the case here. It's harder to say that it will be done because we haven't perhaps got a manager who's going to say, yes, I can assure you that on July so-and-so it'll be done. But in fact, I believe the results are more likely to be good results, and the support will be there not only for it to be accomplished on July, whatever it may be, but for years to come, because it's got the community behind it. It's this risk that has to be involved here. It's the risk that corporations are now taking of saying, let's form teams and let's empower employees and let's trust their judgment, even frontline employees, about what ought to be done, because we've learned that it doesn't work so well the other way. And that's what mitigates that risk. But there is a risk, because we don't know what the ultimate outcome is going to be. We can't go consult the CEO and say, what do you think it'll be in 2 years? Because if he's really doing this authentically, then he's taking the risk with the company and saying, well, I don't know. We'll have to see how this whole strategic process works its way out.
The city of Chattanooga once was labeled the most polluted community in the United States, with air and water pollution threatening not only the natural environment, but human health as well. Today, after successful cleanup measures, Chattanooga is one of the only cities in the Southeast not to have an air pollution problem. In fact, for its efforts, Chattanooga has been recognized by President Clinton's Council on Sustainable Development as a model community. And the United Nations, too, considers the city a model global community. Catanzaro says this attention has brought more attention. Communities around the nation want to know more. He says they welcome this kind of fame.
We certainly do. We want a lot of interplay. This is an exciting venture. I think it revitalizes the community to be involved in not only these projects, but the thinking out of our future. A whole millennium lies before us. A new 100 years, new decades, new opportunities. Why shouldn't we spend our time excitedly thinking out what that future might be and then making it happen?
Dr. Jim Catanzaro, chair of Chattanooga Venture and its Revision 2000 project. He is also president of Chattanooga State Technical Community College. He says the only thing that would make this visioning process fail would be a return to the top-down city government style. Right now, there is no interest in doing this. The vision is only expanding. This is Bruce Robertson. Well, that's our report on the Environment Show for another week. We're glad you joined us. Make a note, tune in again next week for more news on the environment. The Environment Show, a program about the environment, the air, water, soil, wildlife, and people of our common habitat. Our thanks this week to production assistant Wendy Lutz. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, solely responsible for its content. Dr. Alan Shartok, executive producer. This is Bruce Robertson. The Environment Show, made possible by Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the old car hobby. 1-800-CAR-HERE.